The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 11, 2011. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Good to see you all. Tomorrow night, I'll be starting a course on the Xin Qing Ming, which is one of the Zen classics. And this class has always been, we called it the Dawn of Zen, and I would include the Xin Qing Ming in that course and spend maybe three and a half, four lectures on the Xin Qing Ming. And the rest of it was on the Sandokai, or the Merging of Difference and Unity, another classic Zen text. So that was kind of shrinking, the Xin Qing Ming was expanding. But this time around, as we were planning out the curriculum for this year, Bev suggested, well, why don't we just do a whole course on the Xin Qing Ming? So I thought, okay, well, all right, let's do that. But then I left out the Merging of Difference and Unity. We won't be, won't have a place to put that. So I thought I would say a little bit about that text today. I'm just going to talk on four lines from the Merging of Difference and Unity. At first I was thinking maybe I could sweep through the whole thing and give you the everything there is that's contained in this in one talk. I don't think that could be done. So I'll just take four lines. And I think I'll title this talk today, The Ultimate Non-Duality, which is what Vimalakirti speaks of. But how does he do that? Maybe I'll mention something about that at the end. Okay, well, the four lines I want to look at here from Emerging a Difference in Unity. It says, the subtle source. Most of you, I think, know these lines. The subtle source is clear and bright. The branching streams flow through darkness. Grasping things is delusion. Merging with principle, oh, here it says, according with absolute, is still not enlightenment. The subtle source is clear and bright. The branching streams flow through darkness. Grasping things is delusion. According with absolute is still not enlightenment. The subtle source. What is this referring to? What is the subtle source? It says the subtle source is clear and bright. Bodhidharma also speaks of clear and obvious. He uses this phrase, clear and obvious, when he's speaking of self-nature. It's clear and obvious. Of course, we have a teaching, it's very central to our teachings, that we don't find a self. So what is going on? These teachings can be very confusing, you know. You're saying that the, you know, self-nature is clear and obvious, and yet we also point out that we don't find self. And here, Shito, the author of this piece, is saying that the subtle source is clear and bright. Of course, they're speaking of reality, and this would also be self-nature. Ultimate reality, actual reality, not the reality that you think or you believe or you grasp or you think everything is made of or whatever. Not any idea you might have about that, but reality itself. What are we even going to say about that? Bodhidharma speaks of that as clear and obvious. Here, Shito is speaking of this as the subtle source. It's subtle, you know, but it's clear and bright. Well, if ultimate reality is clear and bright, clear and obvious, then why don't I see it? Perfectly natural question. We might think that. Why don't I see it? We look out at the human world, all the confusion, the pain and suffering that we cause for ourselves. It doesn't seem like very many of us, or perhaps even any of us, see ultimate reality, see this thing that suppose, you know, these guys are saying is clear and bright and obvious. So what's the problem here? Why don't we see it? So the subtle source is clear and bright. But it is clear and bright, you see. And it is obvious. It's obvious because you can't not see it. You cannot not see reality. How could that be? And this is what we need to realize about our experience here. We are always experiencing reality directly. Our problem is not that we don't see. Our problem is not that we don't perceive directly reality. We all do, and you shouldn't lose sight of that. What we tend to do, however, is that we, well, as it says here, the branching streams flow through darkness. And he also says, grasping things is delusion. So the branching streams, well, what is this? And flowing through darkness. Yeah, well, this is all the different kinds of stuff that we see. It appears to us as though our experience here is differentiated in all kinds of ways. Different colors and shapes and sounds and smells and tastes and flavors and thoughts and feelings. And it's continuously shifting and changing. So certainly it would seem like, you know, there's all kinds of, well, these branching streams, there's all sorts of things going on here. There's no doubt about it. And these great teachers do not deny that. He's speaking of it right here. The branching streams flow through darkness. So there's nothing wrong with this, in seeing this and that and feeling this and that and thinking this and that. There's nothing wrong with that at all. The mistake we fall into, though, is that then we think, and we'll even say that then we're perceiving reality, because we say, well, I perceive something. I perceive the floor. I perceive you sitting out there. We'll talk like this. Because we think we're perceiving, then we think we're actually experiencing reality, which we are, and we are perceiving reality. But we're confused the moment we start talking like that. If I say, well, I perceive that you are sitting there listening, or maybe some of you, I perceive that maybe some of you are distracted, I don't know. Too early in my talk, perhaps, for any of you to be asleep yet, but, we'll talk like this. And as we do this, you see, we're completely caught up in, well, the branching streams. What is that? Well, that's differentiation, including different people, but also just different things and thoughts and feelings and different shifting things that are occurring here within the environment. And I might be tuned into this or that from time to time. Other things, of course, go by me because I can't tune into everything. You know? This is all we think. Can't take it all in. I can't take in totality. But we think like this and we operate like this because we're completely occupied with, well, the branching streams. And then when we see all these different things, thoughts and feelings, we experience this in various ways. See or taste or hear or whatever is involved here, think. We grasp the different things. Chito here says, grasping is delusion. But that's what we do. And what do we mean, we grasp? You hear me say that all the time. Norm speaks of it too. We grasp things. Does it mean like, well, I grasp this cup here? No, of course. Grasping the cup in my hand. And it isn't like, well, we don't mean that. That's grasping, I suppose. But we grasp things with our minds. And what are we grasping when we grasp? Well, we're grasping the different things that are appearing here, the branching streams that flow through darkness. And then whatever it is that we grasp, we say, well, I perceive this. Perceiving, in the way I would use that term, is always reserved for when we actually see reality. When we're speaking of that. As I said, we always are perceiving reality. But in speaking of that, I would use perception for that. The reason I do that is because the rest of it, we conceive. We conceptualize. This is the mind breaking up the world into this and that. This function of mind we call consciousness is nothing more than that, the dividing up of what is directly perceived and realized and known. And you do know it. You know it now. But in seeing all of these various things, of course, they're all very enticing and exciting or interesting. Well, not all of them, but many of them are. Some are frightening. Some are horrid. Some are terrifying, and or they make us sad or angry. You know, some make us elated and happy, excited. But it's all grasping. There's not even anything really wrong with the grasping, with relating to one thing or another. And of course, when that is taking place, well, then there's also a very strong sense of, well, me too. Here I am. And I am the one who's doing the perceiving, we'll say, not understanding that this isn't perception. We can say, well, I am the one who's conceiving all of this or thinking this. Of course, when we speak this way, then you might get the impression I'm saying, well, you're creating this. Well, sometimes we'll even talk like this. Well, you're the creation of your reality. What is the creation of your reality? What are you referring to as the creation of your reality? And that's what we miss by getting caught up in the conceptualizing, in the grasping the branching streams. And it says the branching streams flow through darkness. Why? Well, at this point in the Sandokai, in the merging of difference and unity, he's using darkness as a metaphor for, well, delusion, ignorance. It's dark, we can't see very well. The subtle source is clear and bright. Well, that sounds like it's very well lit up, even though we don't see it. Or we don't, well, we do see it, but we don't notice it. We're not paying attention. So at this point, you know, the light is sort of a metaphor for enlightenment or awakening or understanding. Darkness, you know, we're in the dark. We don't know what's going on. As you read the Sandokai, I won't get into these other parts, but if you continue in this text, he starts working with these two things, this duality between light and dark. Showing you light can become a metaphor for confusion and delusion. Dark becomes a metaphor for enlightenment. You'll talk this way. And it's very effective. And at this point, without me elaborating on it, you might go, how can you do that? That doesn't make sense. But you just look carefully at what he writes in the text here, and you can see that happening. But of course, the reason we can do this is because it is a text. It's words. He's writing. You know, I'm talking. We're using words. What are these? Well, these are concepts. This is something conceptualized. The words themselves, the text, what I'm saying, these two can be grasped. And usually when we're reading or we're listening, you know, for at least if we're attending carefully, that's what we're intending to do, is to get hold of whatever it is being said or written here. In grasping, now I can understand. That's what we think. Now I can understand. Understand what? Understand that this is delusion? Will you understand that this is delusion by doing that? It might be functional and useful for you to grasp and to get ideas or whatever. There's nothing wrong with this. These teachers never tell us there's anything really wrong with this, but what they do is they point out what this is. And as Shito says here, grasping things is delusion. So grasping words, concepts, right? Grasping the teachings, even the teachings of the awakened, is delusion. The awakened do not grasp these teachings. They just offer these teachings to help direct our attention to what it is that we experience directly, right from the very start. So that's what's going on. In these teachings, but when we grasp it, this very grasping itself is delusion. He goes on in the fourth line that we're looking at today. He says, according with absolute is still not enlightenment. There's another text, the text where I got the title from, the merging of difference unity, which I like the word merging, but it's really the wrong word. But in that translation, if I remember right, and I started speaking it with before I was carefully reading what I had in front of me here, merging with principle, it says in another translation, is still not enlightenment. Now where are we? How do we ever know or realize enlightenment? What is wrong with merging with principle or according with absolute? What would this even be? He says, it's still not enlightenment. Why is he telling us this? Because many people experience something like this. We finally, maybe at long last, notice what is directly experienced. And it has this kind of taste or flavor of oneness about it. And you feel, I felt like I was just one. I was one with the trees and the birds. And it was just such a beautiful day, and I was just right there with it. So this is like merging with principle or according with absolute. You're coming into alignment with that. You're taking. This is still not enlightenment, he says. Why does he say that? I'm asking you now. A lot of times I just ask you and I keep on going, but this time I'm asking you. Why does he say that's not enlightenment? It's still grasping, yeah. So what does that mean? If they're still grasping.
It's not the whole story.
It's not the whole story. Why not?
Separated yourself.
Yes. You're still separate. There's still a you, in other words. Whenever we're operating out of the notion of myself here, we're still caught up in selfhood. We're still caught up in the egoistic view of the world and of the experience here. And we think, I know enlightenment. I've tasted this. I realize this. We forget that elsewhere it's been pointed out to us. There's one teaching I used to love, and my teacher would tell the story of people, you know, looking for the tree of enlightenment, you know, but they would forget that the tree of enlightenment grows on the mountain of egolessness. These are all images. But something to remember about this, that this enlightenment, you know, if you're interested in tasting this enlightenment, this is a matter of forgetting yourself. And in forgetting yourself, don't use this as a gauge, you know, in measuring yourself against something else and then looking for enlightenment in this way. That's just simply not it at all. But we can have this experience where I have now merged with everything and whatever, and now we think that this is enlightenment. We call this oneness. People speak of this as non-duality. Maybe it's a non-duality of sorts, but it's not ultimate non-duality. And because it is not ultimate non-duality, that's why Shi Tuo here points out that, well, this is not enlightenment. Merging with principle, according with absolute, losing oneself in this oneness of all beings, this is still not enlightenment. Because this is still grasping, as Mary points out. This is still, we're still hanging on to something there. And we're still caught up in an intellectual exercise. We're thinking. We're conceptualizing. And we're grasping. So this ultimate non-duality, what is it? What can we even say about this? Well, if you read the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is a very fine sutra, and I'd recommend it, except I'd only recommend reading it with somebody who understands it, because you can get very lost in the Vimalakirti Sutra. Though it's an excellent sutra. That's very, very refined pointing. But there's a chapter in that sutra on non-duality. I almost gave you the punchline, but I'll hold off. But there's a chapter on non-duality. And what it is if I remember right, I think it's, is it Manjushri, who calls upon the different bodhisattvas who had gathered there to give their understanding of non-duality. And they say this and they say that. Wonderful teaching, a lot of wonderful pointing to this, pointing to that. And it gets very subtle. Very subtle. A lot of it, you can look at it right first time through it. You say, oh yeah, I see that. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon it's like, you have to kind of sit with that a bit. And it gets very subtle. And then finally, Manjushri then. There's sort of a debate going on now between Manjushri and Vimalakirti. Manjushri, the wisest of all Buddha's disciples there. None of the rest of them really wanted to talk. The whole sutra is all about the Buddha sending out his disciples to inquire about Vimalakirti's health, because Vimalakirti has been ailing. Vimalakirti is a layman, but a very wise layman. But one by one, each chapter is one of the disciples turning down the Buddha. Well, no, I won't. I can't go see that good man. Why? Well, it's because, he defeated me in a in some subtle form of the teaching. That's what the different chapters are, until we're up to this point where Manjushri will go out and talk to him. So everybody else trots along because they want to see this great debate between Vimalakirti and Manjushri. And I believe we're in this part of the text at that point. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but anyway, here we have, after all the different bodhisattvas then have given their thoughts on non-duality, then Manjushri finally says something. And he's just talking about, basically what he's saying, he's using words to point out how words don't cut it. And showing why this is the case. And then finally they call upon Vimalakirti to offer his teaching, because Vimalakirti always tops them all. He's like in this sutra. And he's a layperson. Don't ever forget that if you're a layperson. This is an important aspect of the teaching too. I won't get into that part. But this understanding doesn't belong to anybody special or to somebody who's taken a vow or whatever. There's reasons for that too. I mean, why to take a vow or whatever. But anyway, here we have Vimalakirti, who in every chapter just outdoes everything. It's just the incredible subtlety of what it is that he points out chapter after chapter. Now they finally ask Vimalakirti, after Manjushri has spoken. This is the end of the chapter. And Vimalakirti, who has been so eloquent, bringing out such profound understanding of various aspects of human life. This is the one chapter in which Vimalakirti says nothing. And that's how the chapter ends. Giving the ultimate teaching of non-duality. And can you see how that has to be so? Well, let me tell you, that has to be so, because can you see how the moment you say something is grasping, as Mary pointed out. The moment you say anything else, the moment you think something is grasping. And when you feel like you have to rely on your thought, on your conceptualization, some act of intellection of some sort, getting some idea about one thing or another, this is delusion. Well, the delusion is in grasping it and believing that, taking hold of it, thinking that, now I have the truth. But if there are words there, concepts, then this is to be involved in confusion. This is to be involved in delusion. Again, at no point is it ever pointed out that this is a bad thing. We just came through an entire chapter at that point, in this particular chapter in the Vimalakirti Sutra, where the various bodhisattvas are bringing out all sorts of very profound teaching. But it ends with pointing out that you understand that everything that's been said here, it is just that. This is a teaching, as all the true Dharma teaching is just pointing. As the Buddha said, it was just a finger pointing at the moon. It is a raft to help us get across the river, so to speak. Of course, these are all metaphors. Once again, they're all graspables. Whatever we say will be that way. What this means is that you need to quiet your mind and look very deeply. Do not say anything. And just see what is seen directly, right now, and within any experience that is taking place. And this is the ultimate non-duality. This is awakening. This is a direct realization. Well, what is there to be seen and realized is a direct realization of actual experience. It is not a conceptual one. I use the analogy of tasting the strawberry or the orange juice or something like that. The actual experience, you can't put that into words. That's to conceptualize it, and that is not knowing the taste of a strawberry. The knowing of the taste of the strawberry is wordless and immediate, direct, and it is not a concept. In that experience, of course, what I'm speaking of is that there's not even one who perceives. There's no perceiver. We could say that there's one who conceives, who's getting the idea, holding ideas. Yeah, well, that's because there's a formation of the self, the ego, along with the object. And now this is a relative world. Now there's a relationship here. And there's time and there's space unfolding as well. And the whole world now begins to appear. This is an illusory world. It's not wrong or bad. It's not like we should try to make it stop happening. It also happens to be reality. Reality is just like that. But we can be confused about what the actual experience is or not. And the not being confused about the actual experience is the realization of what the direct experience is. And it is the realization that of all the formed things that are occurring here, whether it's physical or emotional or intellectual or whatever, is illusory, is constructed, is not in any possession of any kind of own being or persistence. None of these aspects have any, bear any self of any kind. This is why we don't find that self. The only selfhood is there, as the Bodhidharma speaks of it, self-nature being clear and obvious is just thus. Because this is not nothing, and it is just thus. And it's a matter of seeing that directly. And this is what Bodhidharma is speaking of as being clear and obvious. This is the subtle source that Shito is speaking of as being clear and bright. This is what you know. This is what, I say you know. Of course, you don't know this, and nor do I. But this isn't to say that there isn't knowing. There is knowing here. But we can have awareness of that knowing, or we're distracted. We're not present with that. We're not aware of what it is that we know directly. And then we go seeking for all the answers and all the explanation, everything that will satisfy me through these branching streams. This, we occupy ourselves with that. And there's human pain and delusion and confusion. So this final ultimate expression of ultimate reality is wordless, as Vimalakirti was, as the Buddha was on another occasion, maintaining that noble silence. As it is said, noble or otherwise, it's silence. Well, one other thing I did want to say, in view of the fact that this is now the 10th anniversary, of course, we'll make something of that, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And we can look at, say, the people who flew the planes that day, took over the plains. Of course, we might be so filled with anger or hatred or whatever, it's hard for us to see what was going on there. But we can look at them, even if we calm down enough so we can just look at them and see how confused they were, how full of hatred and anger they were. Possibly, is that what it was? And possibly in doing that, maybe we could even find some room to forgive them a little bit. But you see, the thing is that we see something like that. We see something, it doesn't even necessarily have to be so dramatic as all of that. But we see some anger, confusion in someone else. You know, and it's easy for us then to spot that and to make judgments about it. But we're never looking at ourselves. And I don't mean all that we should condemn ourselves, because I don't mean that we should even condemn those others around us who are so confused. What it is that we need to do is to awaken to our own confusion. And that's what this practice and that's what these teachings are about. They're not about taking up a banner and going off somewhere and marching. They're not really about us doing anything en masse. What it comes down to in the end is that each one of us, we look directly into our own heart and mind and see if we can realize where we're confused. Realize when it is, where it is that we are grasping. We're holding to one thing or another. And in that way, and only in that way, I think, we can wake up to our own confusion. And perhaps then, maybe we can help others. We will certainly have plenty of remembrances today of those events 10 years ago. All kinds of things will be said. We might feel like we have to say something, we want to say something, we have to do something, we might feel all sorts of things. But if you can just remember, what you need to do is just to look at your own mind. And this is what we need to learn, just within our own life, within our own heart and mind, to recognize our own confusion, so we can let that go. And of course, now we have to deal with the world as we find it, as it comes up. But we can do that without a judgmental mind, which is a grasping mind, once again. Okay, so I did want to kind of connect what I was saying here to, because it is, and of course there's nothing really special about the 10th anniversary. This shows that we'll make it, because 10, it's kind of a nice round number. We got 10 digits here, we make it a nice one. And, so 10 seemed like a significant number. If we counted in base 12, this wouldn't be such a big deal for us. Two more years from now, we'd make a big deal out of it. But again, what I'm pointing out there is just look at the different ways in which we almost get kind of silly about it. It's sort of crazy. We'll make a big deal. 10 years and we make a big deal. Is this any different than 9 years? Or 9 days later, or whatever? So, and again, I don't even mean to judge or condemn here. I'm just pointing something out, is all. And watch your mind. That's all I'm pointing out. Because we will tend to do things like this. And we'll tend to classify and to round off numbers and whatever. We do all sorts of things. But as long as we know what we're doing, and we don't have to live out of subtle confusion, All right. Well, maybe I've said enough, but do you have any questions about anything I said this morning? Yes, Joel.
The image of darkness being used in this piece, being used in the same way, I don't know if this is an image that shows up a lot in the literature, is it being used in a similar or different way as Tozan used it in Jewel Mirror?
Well, as I was saying here, the image of darkness is being flipped over. But, like, are you talking about, like, the lines like hiding a heron in the moonlight and things like that? And,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's put it this way. Both of these expressions are coming from the same insight or understanding, expressed in different ways. But what Shito's doing here is actually, in moving through this sutra, you know, he's... here a little further on, he says the word dark is used to merge high and low. Well, okay, this is bringing into oneness, you see. Because like in the dark, everything starts to become like one. See? Well, just a moment ago, we were using darkness to represent delusion and all this sort of thing, but now it's starting to represent something that kind of resembles what we otherwise might call awakening, or at least this false awakening of thinking everything is one. See, so he's doing things like this. Whereas in the Sandokai, Jewel Mirror Awareness, similar kind of understanding, but he's expressing it in a different way. You know, like the hiding of the hair. It's really a hiding of an egret in the moonlight, because an egret is white, and the moonlight is kind of, you know, whitish light, or a silver bowl in the snow. Just talking about how right there, these things fade away. The object, and it fades away into wholeness and totality, and yet it's still there, ready to emerge at any point. So these kinds of images are used, yeah. Also, as Sweet Shito points out here, we have where the light is in darkness, and the darkness is in light, and we can look at an example of that. So at the end of it, what do we even mean? You say darkness or light. What do they represent? And what are they? Do they represent anything at all? And if darkness isn't even really darkness and light isn't even really light, we go into the darkness of outer space and it's just filled with light. But we just don't see it because it's all in waveform. So it looks like it's black and dark. And yet if any object that shows up there, it's lit up. So in darkness, there's light. See? We can use images like that from modern science now, but these ancients here understood that intuitively. This is the nature of this. And this kind of understanding of light and dark, they realize is that those are just images that they're using, but they realize the reality of this is the very reality. It's the thoroughgoing reality that we experience. People and things and thoughts and feelings, it's all this way, and you can't get hold of any bit of it, and yet here it is. Here it is, and what is it? But we think we can identify what it is, and then we live in confusion. This is to realize that yes, here it is, but you can't get hold of anything here. And in the understanding of how it is that we actually can't get a hold of anything, now there's actual understanding. And the confusion actually drops away at this point. I don't know if I'm making any sense at all, but... Did that help you, Joe? Yeah, okay. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.